From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The 2001 anthrax case continues to unfold with the FBI's top suspect dead by his own hand and the government under increasing pressure to explain it all. But beyond the criminal investigation, big questions remain about America's bioterror defenses. After 7 years and more than $50 billion, critics say the U.S. remains far too vulnerable. This hour on Point, the anthrax investigation and the debate over biodefense. Joining me now from Washington is Siobhan Gorman, intelligence and homeland security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, nice to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
What can you tell us about how the government made the case about this scientist, Dr. Bruce Ivins, who committed suicide last week and was about to be charged with murder in the anthrax case?
Well, what we know so far is that there was a lot of bioscience that went into trying to narrow down the number of labs that could be involved and sort of allowed the FBI to zero in on the lab at Fort Detrick. And at that point, there were probably about 10 or so people, maybe some more, who could have had access to the anthrax in the lab, the specific strain that seems to have been responsible for the anthrax attacks in 2001. And from there, it sounds like basically the FBI did a lot of sort of straightforward detective work to try to narrow down, at least via circumstantial evidence, down to this scientist, Bruce Ivins. Now, at this point, his colleagues are still pretty skeptical that he was the one, and this is a lab that's been under intense pressure, really, since the investigation started, even though this lab actually participated in some of the earlier FBI investigation into the anthrax attacks. So it's not clear yet, and really, we aren't going to have a lot of certainty, and we may never have actual certainty because there's never been a trial, but the FBI is supposed to finally release some of its evidence as early as this week, and at that point, at least we can have a healthier debate about the suspect here.
The suspect, singular, is there signaling here at any point that the FBI has determined that no one else is culpable in the anthrax attacks, at least of 2001?
That's still a little bit unclear, although so far what we've heard from law enforcement officials and others familiar with the investigation, it seems like Mr. Ivins is the only suspect the FBI has at least zeroed in on.
You wrote a big piece in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, a very comprehensive story about our readiness for another bioterror attack. Can you answer the big question here? After 7 years, over $15 billion spent, what is the United States' overall preparedness for another bioterror attack?
Well, unfortunately, from speaking with a number of experts in this area, and I know that you're going to talk with people more expert than I after we talk, but it sounds like, while there's been some progress, it doesn't necessarily lead to readiness, particularly with bioterrorism. There are so many different handoffs that have to be made in terms of even just responding to a bioterror attack that if you're missing even one of those links, the whole system kind of falls apart. And some of the key sort of weaknesses that were highlighted to me by experts I spoke with were really rudimentary biosurveillance capabilities to sort of sniff out anthrax or other sort of fatal bugs that might be lurking in the air, as well as even though the federal government has made a lot of progress with getting stockpiles of drugs to counteract some of these fatal pathogens, there isn't, even in places like New York City, there's not any solid way to distribute those drugs once they reach a given city or region. And then the third sort of major weakness that was pointed out to me was hospital surge capacity still really is very challenged in most areas of the country.
Mm-hmm. And you write about in your piece, with all the advancements made technologically, whether we've made progress or not, has the biotech revolution in some ways made it easier to develop sophisticated bioweapons?
It certainly has. And, it shows certainly that there are often two sides to scientific advances, because while it leads to a lot of new medical capabilities and antidotes to, diseases and things like that. At the same time, it also means that the number of scientists that have access to, chemicals and biological properties that could be used to launch some sort of bio attack has increased. And, you know, even with anthrax, some of these germs are actually somewhat readily available just in nature. I mean, anthrax exists in lots of agricultural areas just naturally.
Mm. And it's not just about new technologies. You talk about two sides to scientific advancements. It's also about access, right, to these biological agents. We've got thousands of people now, with all this money being spent and new labs being built, who are working with these substances. I mean, is there enough oversight? Is there easier access now to some of these fatal pathogens?
My understanding is that actually there's it's been very difficult to get oversight around it. I mean, in this particular case, it's actually centered on a government lab, which is kind of interesting because in theory there should be the greatest amount of oversight there, and questions have certainly arisen around Mr. Ivins and the fact that he was allowed to retain his security clearance even as the FBI was kind of boring down, and that sort of shows the delicate nature of our innocent till proven guilty system and meshing with things like access to dangerous germs through security clearances. So even in the government area, which should be the best protected, there are a lot of people with access to these kinds of things. But even beyond the government, both in the private sector and certainly the university system, in the name of advancing science, there have been, there's been quite an explosion of people who are involved in these kinds of areas.
Siobhan Gorman is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She joined me from Washington. Siobhan, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We'll be talking this hour with some top experts on bioterror threats and national security. Joining me now from Minneapolis is Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy and a professor at the University of Minnesota. He sits on the National Science Advisory Board on Biosecurity. And from 2001 to 2005, he was the advisor to the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Dr. Osterholm, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
And joining me from Annapolis, Maryland, is Tara O'Toole, CEO and director of the Center for Biosecurity at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. From 1993 to 1997, she served as Assistant Secretary of Energy for Environmental Safety and Health. Dr. O'Toole, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
A lot to get to with you two top experts. Dr. O'Toole, I'll start with you. What kind of technological and scientific advancements have we made in the last 7 years that led the government to this scientist, Dr. Bruce Ivins?
I actually don't know anything about that, but I and my colleagues and many other scientists are waiting with bated breath to hear the FBI case. I mean, it's all very mysterious exactly what they did to single out Dr. Ivins, and I think we'll have to wait and see.
Well, so Dr. Osterholm, tell us, after $50 billion in federal money and all these new labs developing vaccines and stockpiling drugs, has all this money been well spent?
I think we'll all take a step back and say that maybe there's better ways to spend some of this money. But let me maybe address that first question, because I think this is an important issue and one that we're really waiting for the FBI to provide more information on. What's happened over the past 10 years has been a revolution in our ability to look genetically at infectious agents and actually fingerprint them. For example, our group here in Minnesota was a pioneer in looking at that from the foodborne disease standpoint, why today we can match up salmonella strains from around the world and say they're all coming from the very same food source. What happened with the anthrax situation is the FBI, working with a number of academic-based laboratories, have been working on tests to actually fingerprint anthrax spores, not just the bacteria, but the spores, and looks very specifically at could this be the identical match, meaning that if you had 100 spores lined up, you could pick the two that were the only two that matched and be able to demonstrate that. And so what they've done, using this new technology that has been devised largely since 2005, matched up the genetics of the anthrax spores that were sent in the letters that infected the patients and that with what was found at Fort Detrick. Now, we're waiting for more information on the actual specifics of that and just how close that match is. And also, one of the other problems we have that we'll have to wait again for the FBI to unfold their case is, were there an exhaustive investigations done to try to find these spores in any other locations? Meaning, if they do match up with Fort Detrick, which obviously they must, do they also not match up with any other specimens from around the world? Mm. And one of the problems we have is the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, meaning that we don't know maybe some of this. So I think that this is a powerful tool. We'll wait to hear more.
I've got about a minute left before our first break here. Dr. O'Toole, I'll wrap up here with you. Dr. Osterholm mentioned fingerprinting spores and all of this new technology that's happened in the last recent years. Has the government marshaled all of the tools at their disposal in the battle against bioterrorism properly, to your mind?
Well, I think the challenge of creating a robust biodefense has turned out to be much bigger than most of us, and certainly myself, thought it would be in 2001. The key problems in having a good biodefense against would-be attackers are being able to take care of lots of sick people and protect those who are still well. We've made some progress, as Siobhan said, in stockpiling lots of antibiotics should there be another anthrax attack. We've made almost no progress in creating new vaccines and new medicines. So, for example, we do not have a lot of the old, decades-old anthrax vaccine, and we have no new anthrax vaccine as we had hoped to have.
We're talking about bioterror threats and America's readiness 7 years after the anthrax attacks. I want to take a look at the big three categories involved in biodefense with our experts here. Medical stockpiling, biosurveillance and detection, known as BioWatch, and mass casualty response. You both mentioned and talked about the anthrax vaccine a bit. Talk about the BioWatch program, biosurveillance, if you will, for a moment. Dr. Osterholm, what's been the progress in that area?
Well, actually, I think that we've made substantial progress in that area, given from where we started in 2001. While there have been critics of this program, this is a program that basically is measuring the air on a constant basis in more than 30 cities around the country, trying to detect a potential release early, meaning before we would otherwise pick it up with human cases. This is a technology that has demonstrated how accurate it is in the sense that we've had over several million tests conducted, and to date there has not been a single false positive, meaning a false alert. We have had alerts, and it turns out that these were organisms that actually came from nature, but the organisms that we are concerned about that could have been a terrorist event. Mm. Now, there are still problems with the program in that the time it takes to get the test result is slow. The actual way that we're going to use the test result, meaning the fact that how the community will respond, still has to be worked out. But it's a work in both progress and process, and I think that while there are critics of it, I think it's come a long ways, and I think it does have potential for the largest population areas to do give us that early warning.
Let's talk about
Dr. O'Toole,
go ahead.
View of that.
Okay.
I would agree with Mike that the BioWatch system, the environmental sensor system, has improved over the years. But I think his final comment that we're not quite sure how to use it is a very important one. And I would say that we've spent too much time and energy working on how we would detect the early stages of a bio attack or a natural epidemic, for that matter. And we haven't spent enough time creating communication systems we would need to achieve what the Army, what the military calls situational awareness, the ability to know what's going on once we know we're in a crisis. We haven't made all that much progress in improving communications, for example, between hospitals and between state public health agencies and across regions of the country. So I would grade the biosurveillance progress, I think, at a lower level than Mike might.
Let's use a hypothetical. Let me just use a hypothetical to answer the question in this way. What if there is an attack at in a subway in some major city, New York, for example? What does the response look like? How far have we come in a possible response someplace like that?
Jane, I think before we even go there, I think we have to be real clear here because we're really mixing apples and oranges. BioWatch is one small part of the surveillance activity. I've spent the last 30 years of my life doing disease surveillance at the community, regional, and statewide level. And there are many different ways that we do disease surveillance and looking for organisms in the environment. BioWatch is just one small piece of it, so let's not confuse that, okay?
Yeah.
That is an important issue. I think Tara's point is right on about the issue of communications. How do we correspond between all the different partners that are out there? I think we've made more advances than Tara gives credit for. I've been a participant in a number of regional meetings in the 30 largest cities where we've actually had this program. The fact that we've had these false alerts, meaning false in the sense that they were real finds, but they were not terrorist attack related, we've actually had drills, real-time, actual events, where we've made tremendous progress in the last 18 months to be able to know how a community will react. And today, I think some of our communities are reacting quite well. The point, though, gets back to then once they do start to react, what are the resources and what are the things that we have to help them react with and for? And that's the point, I think, of your question, what would happen in New York City today if, in fact, we found anthrax spores had been released in a number of subway stops or at least several subway stops.
Dr. O'Toole?
Well, I think one of the points to be made is that we are trying to deal with a national security issue, a bioterrorism attack, via 3,000 different public health departments at the city, county, and state level. And they all have different capabilities, and many of them have very different plans. New York is arguably one of the most advanced and experienced public health departments in the world. And yet, a few months ago, when it was revealed that New York's plan, which is led by the police department, by the way, regarding how to respond to an anthrax attack would include essentially shutting down the city. In other words, when they get word that people are sick with anthrax or when BioWatch goes off, however they find out there's been an anthrax attack, one of their first moves would be to close the bridges and the tunnels and not let anybody in or out of the city. There were a lot of people at this meeting, including federal officials, who weren't sure that that was a good operational plan. So the challenge we have, and one of the reasons progress, I think, has been modest and slow and very different in different parts of the country. Mike, for example, comes from Minnesota. I think he would agree that is one of the most organized regions in the country in terms of being able to respond to an epidemic. What we're trying to do is create a national security policy state by state and city by city.
Is that right, Dr. Osterholm? The level of response is different in different places of the country?
I think Tara is absolutely right on point there. I think that's one of the challenges that we have is how do we basically build a national response when you do have 3,000 local health departments and 50 state health departments. On top of that, I think that the issue that you alluded to at the beginning of the show, which does tie in here, is our surge capacity at the local level. And Tara is clearly one of the world's experts on this issue. The fact of the matter is that everything will hinge upon the local healthcare delivery system's capability. The feds will come in with their medicines. They'll bring some relief in terms of some additional healthcare workers. But today, basically, we've gnawed our healthcare system down to the bone, and we're sucking calcium. We basically have no surge capacity in our local level for this kind of thing. And so I think this is an important point because that will dictate to a very real degree how the response unfolds. And today, we've never really been challenged. As bad as 9/11 was, it wasn't really that bad relative to a surge response because we had so few victims that survived. We didn't have thousands and thousands of people trying to find emergency room beds somewhere in the city. And I think that's the challenge that all of us worry about with a bioterrorism event of any magnitude. And let me just add one last point that I worry about. People look at the 9/11 anthrax situation, 22 cases, 5 deaths, and they poo-poo it and say, bioterrorism, you guys have blown this out of proportion. If that same very powerful bullet had been fired through a much more effective gun than a letter, an envelope, but through an aerosolizer, Tara and I would both tell you that there could have been many thousands and thousands of casualties from that situation.
But to our big thesis in this hour, Dr. O'Toole, after $50 billion spent on all this, shouldn't we be further along?
Well, you know, $15 billion sounds like a whole lot of money to me, but if you look at it in terms of national security, it's a pittance. We're spending $66 billion in 1 year on the FA-22 Raptor. We're spending $44 billion on the stealth bomber airplane. So if you look at it in terms of the public health budget, it's a lot of money. If you look at it in terms of national security, and particularly given the seriousness of the threat, as Mike said, and I would note that multiple government analyses done by many different agencies keep coming to the same conclusion, i.e. that a single anthrax attack, for example, could kill tens of thousands. But we have made progress. For example, in hospital preparedness, there's no doubt that those states that have really experienced disasters are ahead of the ones who haven't. North Carolina, for example, has a very strong response capacity in their hospital system, in part because they've gone through years and years of flooding and hurricanes, and they know how important it is. We have found in our studies that hospitals across the country actually have made discernible progress in their preparedness for disasters in the last 5 years, partly as a consequence of the federal funding they've gotten. But it's mostly preparedness for normal disasters, you know, bus crashes, hurricanes, things like that. As Mike said, we're not ready to handle a big mass casualty event with hundreds or thousands of people needing care. We're starting to think about that now and trying to work on this very difficult problem. But in a healthcare system that is as fragmented as ours, that is as financially stressed as ours, and that is all in the private sector, that's a really big challenge. And one of the things...
A lot of pieces to this puzzle. Dr. O'Toole, I've got to cut you off for a moment because we have so many callers lined up here, and I want to get some of them in before we move on. Mark is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What you've been talking about has sort of mirrored the thoughts I was having about it. These small attacks after 9/11... really don't show the kind of scale that I've been led to believe, both by the media and the popular fiction treatment, starting with Ian Fleming back in the 60s, of a mass biological attack. The question I have is, what, if anything, is being done to actually prevent the attack as opposed to just responding to it once it's already in the air?
Good question, Mark. Thank you.
Is there anything that can be done?
I hear you. Dr. Osterholm, let me turn that to you.
Well, this is the zillion-dollar question as to what can we do. In this country, as was noted at the top of the hour, I serve on a group called the National Science Advisory Board on Biosecurity, which is trying to assure that we have standards and ways to detect the potential misuse of biologic agents or the tools to deliver them by legitimate academic centers, businesses, et cetera, that might handle these organisms. But that surely does not put any kind of barrier necessarily on someone whose sole intent is a nefarious use or bad use of the bug. And I think that Tara would tell you the same thing, that today our modern technology has made it possible for people to do things with infectious agents, both genetically modify them and deliver them in ways that even 15 or 20 years ago, only the highest skilled and well-funded government programs in the world could do. We've just made it modern technology out there. And so this is a real challenge. And one of the things that we're trying to do in our academic programs is just tighten things up, not because we believe that this is a government-sponsored or would leak to a government-sponsored program, but it's the Lone Ranger. It's that lone offender out there that might very well go and try to do something. But beyond that, it's going to be tough, and that's one of the challenges we have living in a free world society where, frankly, the vast majority of scientific findings are of great benefit to human and animal populations, but they could also be turned on their head and used for nefarious purposes.
I want to take another call here from Jordan, who is in Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Jordan. Welcome to On Point. Well, are you there, Jordan?
What? Yes.
Go ahead.
My point would be we need to enact more preventative measures, such as a civil defense plan. Now, if you go to ready.gov, it basically tells you to prepare for 2 weeks, but it says nothing of having a particulate filter or anything of the sort. And I'm only 22, so I don't know what the civil defense plan was back, you know, when it was like bomb shelters and whatnot, and a global conflict and scare of nuclear Holocaust, but
you're still thinking about it, and you're still worried about it. I hear the point, Jordan. It's a good one. Dr. Osterholm, what do you think? Some sort of civil defense plan, gas masks, microfilters for everyone?
Well, the problem we have with that is that it's after the fact. I mean, the ability to respond to a release is one that we know at the time that it even happened, and once it passes through the community, the damage has been done. There is some question about some of the organisms. Could they, in fact, be re-aerosolized? A disease like smallpox, one that we've made major inroads in, and one that a mentor to both Dr. O'Toole and I, D.A. Henderson, led the world in the effort to eradicate this, but we worry that it still might be around. Today we have vaccines that we could use that wouldn't stop the initial hit necessarily, but surely would quickly bring subsequent human-to-human transmission to a stop. But in a sense, I mean, we don't want citizens out there all worried that every day is going to be the biologic agent hit. And therefore, I don't recommend that you stockpile, quote-unquote, anti-biologic agent issues. Another area that I deal a lot with is pandemic preparedness. If pandemic influenza, I do worry about that one and what people can do to stockpile for that. But I think for biologic agents, this is where the government's got to be able to respond, come in quickly, and help communities be able to deal with it.
And yet in New York City, as I'm reading in one of these pieces, I think it's the Washington Post, if a lethal agent is detected, the city still has to make a plan to actually get medication out of the airport and government storage where it is and into the communities. I mean, these are simple things that haven't yet been thought through, I guess, huh?
But, you know, Jordan has a good point with his concern about civil defense. You know, I spent a lot of my life on nuclear weapons and preventing accidents involving nuclear weapons. And in the case of a nuclear terrorist attack, a terrorist getting hold of a nuclear weapon and unleashing it, what you want to do is prevent that from happening. All right, and we know how to do that. We need to get all the fissile material that are the necessary components of a nuclear weapon and lock it up. That is not a viable strategy for biodefense. It's going to be almost impossible to prevent these kinds of attacks because the organisms are everywhere. They're not just in the high containment labs. That's probably where they're safest, actually. They live in the world, and very soon we're going to be able to create them from scratch. We can create viruses from scratch now. We've made, for example, the 1918 flu. What we have to have is a defense not just against bioterrorism attacks, but against epidemics and disasters that is so robust that it's not worth the terrorists' time to try and attack us. And we can do that. That's the bright side of these technologies. We can create the medicines and vaccines we need. You identify a real problem thus far. That is, how do we get the medicines that the feds have stored up to people when they need them in a very short amount of time?
Right.
I think the answer to that is using the private sector. This is not something government is going to be able to do on its own. But we get mail and we get packages from one place in the world to another within 24 hours with no trouble. We all, or many of us, are sitting in big office buildings, which if they had caches of these medicines, could distribute it not only to the residents of the building, but to their families very, very quickly. We have to figure out how to use the private sector as part of the solution to that particular piece of the problem.
Some sort of partnership. Sounds like a lot still needs to be discussed. Dr. Tara O'Toole, Dr. Michael Osterholm. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Alan Pearson, Director of the Biological and Chemical Weapons Control Program at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. In recent years, he's worked at the Department of Homeland Security to streamline and refine the bioterror spending. Alan Pearson, welcome to On Point.
Hello, I'm glad to join you.
Thank you for being here. Since the anthrax attacks in 2001 and $50 billion in response to that, how much progress do you think the government has made fighting bioterrorism?
Well, I think I would have to agree with much of what Drs. O'Toole and Osterholm have been saying regarding our readiness for this. Certainly they are much more expert when it comes to sort of the public health aspects of this than I am. And I think what we've seen so far has been a fairly limited return on the investment we've had. I think what we now have is an opportunity for a more careful assessment of all the effort we've had and what it is getting us, what it's not getting us, so we can move ahead in what I would think is a more rational and thoughtful way. I did want to comment on something that Dr. O'Toole said before the break.
Okay.
Regarding whether it's almost impossible to prevent an attack and the notion that these organisms are simply everywhere in the environment and perhaps are, in fact, safest in these high-containment labs. I think that's something that has really come into question given the events of last week, whether, in fact, these organisms are safest in the high-containment labs and just how available some of these organisms are in the natural environment. And Ames strain anthrax, which is what was used in these attacks, is extremely virulent, and it's not at all apparent to me that one could simply go out into the soil and come up with an anthrax strain of that virulence very easily. So I think from my perspective, one of the areas we've been particularly weak on then is the whole aspect of preventing attacks from occurring in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some real questions to be asked about the real explosions in one area, this one aspect of the $50+ billion we spent, and that is this explosion in biodefense and bioterrorism directed research and the inadequacies and oversight.
The inadequacies. You've talked about the limited return on our money. You say that we should move ahead in a rational and thoughtful way. Does that mean pouring more money in addition to the $50 billion we've already spent, or should we move in a totally different direction? Alan Pearson.
First of all, I would agree, actually, with Drs. O'Toole and Osterholm that where we've got great weaknesses is actually in some of the basic public health infrastructure, and that is not the R&D aspects. That is exactly aspects of how you deliver the medicines, how you do the surge capacity, and particularly there's concerns about funding for simply the public health workforce, and numerous reports indicating tremendous deficits there, and we've got a budget that's been put out by President Bush for next year that cuts $500 million from public health professions, education, and training programs. It virtually eliminates those programs. Those are areas where we should be spending the money. I think we get a much more limited return when we spend money focusing on developing countermeasures for specific agents that are a threat only from the perspective of a bioterrorism attack. An anthrax vaccine will not help us with the everyday public health threats that we face. We have
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, Dr. O'Toole, jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah. I welcome more scrutiny on the safety in these laboratories. And in fact, there's a bill already introduced in the House and introduced in the Senate by Senators Kennedy and Burr to take a look at the labs, to take a look at the select agent rule, and make sure everything is as it should be and as stringent as it ought to be. We ought to pass that bill. That said, I disagree that it's a waste of money to develop countermeasures to these bioweapons agents. We have an opportunity here in the United States, because of the advances made in bioscience, because we're in a revolution in bioscience and we're leading it, at least for the moment, in the United States, to figure out how we can make drugs and vaccines, and not just for anthrax, fast and cheap, in a way that would not only make us very difficult to attack with a bioterrorism agent, but that would help us deal with pandemic flu, with SARS, with other emerging diseases that we're going to have to confront, and with antibiotic resistance and all the rest of this. This money can be more adroitly targeted, I think, and I think HHS has made enormous progress even in the last 18 months in improving the program to get more medicines and drugs against bioterrorism.
Dr. Osterholm, what do you think?
No, I agree 100% with Dr. O'Toole. I think she's right on target with that. I think that to a certain degree, the deterrence for a bioweapon use is not just the ability to make sure that it doesn't get in the hands of the bad guys, because we'll never guarantee that, but it's also what we call in public health secondary prevention, primary prevention being stop it from ever happening. Secondary prevention is, can you greatly limit its impact in such a way as to reduce the overall threat of the terrorist event to ever happening, because it's not going to have a big impact. And I think that Tara is right on target with that. I think we can do that. I think where this all comes to play is the fact, though, that if just resources, if we're going to be limited in resources, then how do we allocate them? And I think that is where I think all three of us would agree on this call, that public health and the ability for local healthcare delivery systems to respond
is a critical asset that we are not at this time really supporting in a way that's going to allow us to change this laissez-faire approach that we have, and that's going to take funding that we need to have. So if we have limited dollars, I'd put it there, but I think Tara is absolutely right. If we have additional resources, which we should have, this would be a major payoff down the road.
Very interesting. Let's get back to the phones now. More callers joining us here from Providence, Rhode Island. First, Paul is on the line. Welcome to you, Paul.
Hi.
Hi.
These scientists are just fear merchants, and in a very big way, this show is all about merchandising fear too. The metaphor I always use is a new parent. You know, with kids, when you have a baby, you go around putting taping up all the plugs and things, and then as the toddler gets a little older, you start thinking, oh, maybe he's going to drink the Clorox or get a knife and stab himself. But then you start to relax and say, oh, well, this child is intelligent, you know. They're not going to do these things. If we look around, there's chemicals, there's oil, there's radiation sources everywhere. If we start trying to scare ourselves, we'll do it, and we'll bankrupt ourselves. You know, we do need a national health care policy, but the only thing that's really going to stop terrorism is if our foreign policy stops giving other people a reason to hate Americans. And as far as I can see, we're going totally in the wrong direction on that.
Paul, thank you. I appreciate it.
I must respond to that, because I think this is a very unfortunate attitude that far too many people in this country have. Let me just begin by saying, first of all, is that we don't need to have a foreign entity be the perpetrator. In fact, the proof does bear out on the post 9/11 anthrax situation, it wasn't a foreign terrorist. Today there are kooks, there are nuts, there are people in this country who are willing to consider these kinds of activities without a foreign issue. So I don't want to minimize the foreign policy implications. But, you know, the other part of it is that these are events. Remember in 9/11, 22 cases of a disease almost brought down the U.S. postal system. Had we had more transmission, it would have. Terrorism can do things to society that natural disasters just don't do. And so, you know, while none of us would sit here and tell the Californians, don't worry about earthquake-proofing your buildings because, you know, they're going to only happen big ones every 70 to 100 years, we still go ahead and do that. And so I think that today the cost-benefit ultimately to society of preparing for these events, which none of us on this call can guarantee will happen, but we surely can give you a good idea will. Let me just close by saying that on 9/11 of 2000, 1 year to the day before, I published a book called Living Terrors, which in that book I talked about the World Trade Center towers and the Al-Qaeda. And for the year after 9/11 of 2000, I was again accused, like many others who deal with this issue, of fear-mongering, of this whole thing. On the morning of 9/11 of 2001, I couldn't understand why everybody was so surprised. As horrible and as terrifying as that was, why was everybody surprised? And I think that what you have here are three people on this call that would tell you none of us are going to guarantee there will be another major terrorist event, but there surely is a high likelihood. And if there is, and we're not prepared, the cost that we will suffer for not being better prepared will far, far outstrip anything that we've invested into that area. And at that time, it doesn't help to prove the caller wrong, that in fact we weren't just fear-mongering.
Alan Pearson, let me bring you back into this, because I think this is an interesting time to bring up this point. 7 years down the road here, $50 billion spent. What are the primary areas of waste, to your mind, in our bioterrorism spending?
Well, I think we need to get back to this issue. I mean, if you're going to ask about waste, I do think we need to get back to this research and development issue. I would agree with Tara that HHS has shifted in the last year or two towards taking a more broad-spectrum approach, if you will, to developing countermeasures, things that are not quite so agent-specific, and that's the way we need to go. I'm concerned, and as Dr. Osterholm said, we need to worry. We don't need to think about this only as coming from outside. The recent events appear to see that we can see this coming from inside. The Hartford Courant reported back in October of 2006 that over 7,000 scientists and other individuals are approved to work with anthrax in this country. That's an expansion since 2001. We have to ask whether that's the right way to go, and whether that aspect, that one aspect, is increasing our security or not. We have to look very carefully and rationally at what specifically do we need to take the anthrax threat off the table, and ask whether that is the right response to getting what we need.
That goes to the point of access, which we talked about earlier. Dr. O'Toole, I heard you wanted to jump in here. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened after 2002 is we threw a lot of money on the streets because we were frightened and we wanted to do what we could. I think we wasted a lot of money on biosurveillance at the beginning because we didn't know how to do it effectively, for example. In 2002, HHS had never run a program that was supposed to design and manufacture new drugs before, and it only had about 12 people working on it. They now have about 100 people who are hired with the appropriate expertise, and that program is now being much more professionally managed. I think this is, unfortunately, the tale of most government programs is, you know, you start out not knowing much and you learn as you go. Mm-hmm. These are not programs that you can take models, that you can model after private sector efforts. These are things that government does uniquely. And they're very tough tasks. I think, you know, you can always improve. But I think $50 billion is a very cheap bill. I mean, again, if you put this in national security terms where we ask not how much will it cost, we ask what do we need to defend the nation? And we spend a whole lot of money on things like the B-2 Spirit bomber, $44.1 billion. We spend $66 billion on another airplane.
So it's all so relative. I hear what you're saying.
It is all relative.
Let me bring another caller in here at this point. Ellen is in Medford, Massachusetts, and I want to get her in. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to direct this to Dr. Pearson. It has been argued by scientists opposing the proliferation of so-called biodefense research, and there are now 1,300 level 3 labs in the country. I think there are 4 level 4 labs. There has been a struggle in Boston against BU's developing a level 4 lab. Its level 3 lab is up and running. But scientists have argued that developing biological weapons will set off an arms race. Against the argument that these labs do not develop biological weapons, the Pentagon has stated that its goal is to develop genetically engineered biological weapons to discover defenses against them. And these inevitably will have offensive capabilities. Now,
what's your question? I'm running
security,
out of time, Ellen.
Can I please help me finish?
Okay, go ahead quickly.
Security is a biological weapons convention against the proliferation of biological weapons that would halt this research. May I have Dr. Pearson's comment on that?
Thank you for your question, Ellen. Go ahead.
Well, I think we have to be very careful of how we portray this, but I think what the caller is alluding to is the concerns that are out there about the proliferation of the activities, and I think they're concerns that may be shared by people around the world. I think it would be very interesting to think about how the rest of the world is viewing the events this week and the distinct possibility that the anthrax attacks of 2001, which really set off this more recent phase of a biodefense boom. It started actually under the Clinton administration, but it really took off after the anthrax attacks in 2001. One wonders what the rest of the world is thinking at this moment.
Well, there's some inaccuracies in your statement, Alan. The bioterrorism programs that the U.S. is pursuing were begun in the Clinton administration, long before the 2001 attacks.
Yes, I think
it's very important that all of these programs be completely transparent and open to scrutiny from people in the neighborhood as well as other scientists from other countries. I just want to clarify that these, you know, hundreds of BSL-3 and BSL-4 labs existed before these programs began. These are not primarily or even mostly biodefense labs. There's only been 13 new BSL-3 labs created for biodefense.
That's correct, too.
So let's be clear about this. There's lots.
Let me jump in because we're running out of time, and I've got about a minute left to give Dr. Michael Osterholm the last word on all of this. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I think that this discussion is a very healthy one, and I think that these are the kinds of issues we need to address. But I want to reiterate a couple of points. One is none of us know if another terrorist event is going to occur, but I think we'd all agree that the likelihood is there, and that with both the combination of perpetrators, the increased ability to genetically modify organisms and even deliver them, this makes the challenge an ever-increasing problem. The second thing, I think, is that Terry hit it right in the head. Our programs should be transparent in this country. We're not trying to hide anything, but they have to be put into perspective of other defense-related costs, and this is a major defense. And finally, every attack will be local, and so that we need to better understand what are the local needs to be able to respond from a health standpoint, from a detection standpoint, and that is not something we typically think of in terms of national defense, but it's key, and that's an important point to consider now.
Thank you to all my guests for a very lively discussion today. I appreciate your different perspectives. Dr. Tara O'Toole, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, thanks so much, Dr. O'Toole.
Pleasure.
Dr. Michael Osterholm of the University of Minnesota, thanks to you, Doctor.
Thank you.
And Alan Pearson for the Center of Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Great to talk to you, Alan. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.